helping the body of Christ proclaim the truth of Christ in a post-Christian world. This is Apologetics Profile.
With the advent of transportation and communications technologies, it seems that the world has quite literally been brought to our doorstep. You do not have to travel much further than your local grocery store to bump into someone maybe from India, China, or Pakistan. This influx of so many people from so many different countries also includes a wide variety of different religious beliefs. As Christians, how are we to respond to such a burgeoning religious pluralism? There is no one-size-fits-all easy answer to the question. Your neighbor may practice Tibetan Buddhism, Taoism, some school of Hinduism, or a certain sect of Islam. Perhaps you have met people who follow Krishna or Vishnu, or maybe you've discovered a coworker practices the Baha'i faith. And if we are honest with ourselves, we may discover in such encounters with people of other faith traditions that they know more about their beliefs and way of life better than we know our own Christian faith. Our special guest this week and next on The Profile is author, scholar, and world religions expert Winfried Cordwan. Wynn has traveled the world, engaging countless numbers of people of other faith traditions, visiting their mosques, temples, and synagogues. He has just recently published the third edition of his extensively researched classic, Neighboring Faiths, A Christian Introduction to World Religions. If you have ever had to take a course on world religions at a Christian school or university, you may have had to read Wynn's book. It is arguably the foundational resource for Christians on the topic of world religions. We here at The Profile want to give two of you a brand new copy of Neighboring Faiths, courtesy of InterVarsity Press Academic. To get your copy, just email me, Daniel Ray, at dray@watchman.org with your current mailing address. That's dray@watchman.org, and we will draw two listeners at random, notify you by email, and IVP will ship you a hot-off-the-press hard copy. Thanks to Krista Clayton at IVP for the books and for setting up our interview with Wynn. Here on part one, Wynn outlines a broad definition of religion, and he also dispels the assumptions from secular academia that monotheism is a later development within an evolutionary paradigm of religious belief. There is significant evidence which demonstrates quite the opposite, namely that monotheism is the foundation from which polytheism emerges. So whether you think you've got a good handle on world religions, or if you think the topic is just far too vast for you to comprehend, Wynn and his rich life experiences are sure to give you fresh insight, wisdom, and encouragement to love your neighbors of different faith traditions as yourself.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of different things that can be included in religion. And ultimately, you know, it really doesn't make all that much difference. It's a scholar's thing. I mean, for the average person, you know, he really would not care whether Buddhism is classified as a religion or not. Those of us who are engaged in that world, it becomes important to distinguish between what really is a different religion, what really is just a part of one. Now, let me give you some encouragement concerning your story a moment ago, your pronunciation of Shahada or Shahada. If you were in Egypt, it would be pronounced Shahada. Mm. So there's a lesson there. When it comes to the languages and expressions, the terms, you can't ever really please everyone. You will always run into sects, differences in doctrines, just as you do with Christianity. Christianity represented by the Pope is very different than the Christianity represented by J. Falwell Jr. And that is true for all religions that I know of. And the same thing applies to the commitment spectrum. There are some people who are deeply devout, specifically in their sub-region, whereas there are going to be others who really don't care all that much so long as their name appears among those who attended the important functions or whatever. Now, it's easy to say religion has to do with you and God, but then that becomes a tendentious statement when you realize that God, capital or lowercase g, really means many different things to many people, and you wind up running into a distinction between religion as you see it in the books, such as mine, though I try to be as careful as I can, and religion as the people actually live it. So Buddhists are quick to point out to you that Buddha is not a god, and they don't worship Buddha. They venerate him and partake of his power and so forth. But on the level of the layperson, they certainly worship Buddha, pray to him and the bodhisattvas, and even include the Hindu gods and so forth. So it's obviously, if a god is involved, can you still hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Obviously, if a god is involved, it's pretty easy to say it's religion, but then that may be too specific to accompany everything that we consider to be religion. And so I have to extend it to something transcendent, something that goes beyond the world, and that I relate to not just by saying, okay, it's there, but through some kind of accepted method of action. So my rough and ready definition for religion is then engaging with a transcendental reality by means of a particular special way of acting, such as, you know, going to church, praying, carrying out ritual, and so forth.
Okay. So ritual in relation to a transcendent reality that may or may not involve God or gods.
Yeah, something like that. I'm sure that if you look hard and fast enough, you can find someplace, somewhere, that you would still consider a religion, but might not fit under my definition.
Gotcha.
But I definitely reject the idea that, say, football is somebody's religion, even though they spend a lot of time and effort on it, or money is somebody's god. Well, no, not really. I mean, it may play the central role in their life, but there's nothing transcendent about it.
Very this worldly, as you've said in the book. There's a lot of just emphasis on this world and not anything beyond or in the next or something that transcends it. Yeah.
Right.
You deal with, and I thought this was wonderful in the beginning part of the book, you talk about the current secular sociological assumptions about religion in cultures, that it was polytheistic, pantheistic, and then it morphed into a more refined monotheism. And that's just kind of an evolutionary assumption about how religions developed. But what you argue and show quite clearly is that what is original to religion, even the most ancient of cultures, is a monotheism. Talk a little bit about that.
It's really an intriguing point. And I think a lot of people who talk about that or engage with the topic miss the most important aspect of engaging in such a search. I mean, you can look at all the so-called primitive religions, those that are underdeveloped materially and so forth, and has taken inventory, and lo and behold, about half of them believe in some kind of creator God, half of them only believe in spirits.
Mm.
So we can't do this by counting heads.
Yeah.
You have to be able to somehow separate what is really original versus what is a later development. And this is where Wilhelm Schmidt, the German scholar, made such an important contribution. His predecessor, as it were, he said, okay, we find monotheism in all of these religions and we find animism, but I'm stumped as to how you can tell which is earlier. And he thought maybe they both arose around the same time, not out of each other. But then Wilhelm Schmidt wound up using what's called the cultural historical method. And he said that we need to figure out which cultures are more developed than others and look to those that really are the least developed in terms of material progress.
Right.
And the like. And so, can that be done? Of course. A tribe that has bow and arrow and perhaps even metal implements probably is more advanced than a horde of people who only use sticks that they cut from a tree for their weapons. You can tell if a culture is oriented towards war versus one that is trying to live peacefully. It's a very significant point. Namely, you do not use shields if you only go hunting. Show me a culture that has shields, and we're looking at a culture that is definitely one step advanced over the other. And, you know, I'm just using very simple arguments here, but a tribe in which it is mandatory for adolescents to be tattooed is probably more advanced than one where that is not a practice. I mean, do you think that the first people who came to live on Earth for whatever reason started out with saying, oh, we're here, we need to tattoo ourselves? I doubt that. I suspect that's a later development. Yeah. Same thing with music, with stories. I have a couple of examples in the book. One is, you know, which story was probably the first? And it's the one that probably has the most common elements with all of the various developments.
Makes sense.
You know, you can discover layers of cultures. And then when you do that, it becomes the most probable that the religions of the least developed people, those who most closely apparently represent the early stages of human culture, were those who believed in one God, monogamy, obedience to certain moral commandments, and a whole lot of things that, of course, a lot of people do not want to accept.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the favorite ideas even now is that marriage is a very late concept, and that human reproduction was started with, quote, group marriages, and then the idea of monogamy is a very late development. That does neither make logical sense, nor is there any evidence for that.
Gotcha. So it seems that when we look at the common denominators of the most primitive cultures, looking back as far as we can, we see elements of monotheism incorporating most everything that we see in common with religions today.
Yes. Let me put it this way. If you can't accept some kind of criterion for developing the history of a culture, you really are up a creek. And there are people who to this day argue that in order to find monotheism, you first of all have to have polytheism. And I don't know why that should be a mandate, but they make it such. And then you're out of the polytheism, then emerges one of the chief gods. For example, some people have referred to the Ebla tablets and said there's a committee of gods there, and then one emerged from them as the chairman of the pantheon, and then he became the predecessor of El or Yahweh and so forth. But you're not looking at an ancient culture, at least not by the cultural historical method. You're looking at an extremely well-defined culture. And it's possible that a head god, emerged from a committee. But you can't turn that into a rule.
Yeah.
And in fact, if you look at not tablets from 2000 BC, but you go back and extrapolate to what you see, say, in the Vedas, you see that it started with the god of the sky, Deus Pitar. And then you see him slowly losing significance as other gods in the pantheon become important. And the reason why that's so interesting is that, in fact, you see basically the same pattern in other religions within the Indo-European language community, because you have in Greek, you have Zeus Pater. In Latin, among the Romans, you have Jupiter. And on you go along that line, you still have remnants. Say, okay, among the Norse, you have Teos. So it's not just an accident that it happened in Indian culture, that it started with the creator god Deus Pitar, but since it spread so early among the distribution of Indo-Europeans, we're looking at something that must have been far in the background of what was recorded in the Vedas eventually.
Okay. So it seems that taking this idea that monotheism was primary in ancient religions, I want to talk about the necessity of how you view, because there seems to be two views when we're talking about religion in general here, and I noticed this theme throughout your book, was the idea of whether it's monotheistic or polytheistic or panentheism, or if it's kind of a Buddhist where there's not really an emphasis on a god, where somebody like a Buddha becomes a divine through climbing the ancestral ladder. It seems, Wynn, that there's a distinction between personal religion, like a personal deity or deities governing the cosmos, and impersonal forces. And I found this interesting because it seems like with modern science, you hear a lot of the talk about forces and they're impersonal, right? And what you were talking about in some of these religions, that there is an impersonal force or forces at work.
Okay.
So can you make that distinction? Talk a little bit about that, the personal versus the impersonal in terms of religious belief.
Yeah, of course we can't really talk about the personal because it's beyond all, the non-personal because it's beyond all of our categories of thinking.
Uh-huh.
But leaving that aside for a minute.
Okay.
Yes, there are such things as Advaita Hinduism, where the true God, well, he is really behind, beyond all of our logical and linguistic categories. And so that's the real reality. And if you're philosophically inclined, you're going to relate to Brahman without attributes by way of Brahman with attributes.
Okay.
Shankara, who is the leader, who was the founder, I guess, of Advaita Hinduism, which by many people is viewed as, quote, the Hinduism.
Mm-hmm.
He worshipped the Brahman without attributes by way of Shiva, which was Brahman's expression to the world with attributes.
Okay, yeah.
Same thing with Ramanuja, or Ramanuja, however you want to pronounce it. He basically believed in an impersonal reality, though he may have put the personal ahead of it, but his personal worship would have been with Vishnu or Ram. So on the personal level, you really can't help but worship a personal God, because that's how you can relate. Now, you may come to the realization and maybe a moment of enlightenment that there's a further reality which is beyond us, and you are that. You are identical with the impersonal force. Okay.
Brahma is Atman, and you are Brahma. Yeah. You are Atman. It's inside of you, kind of thing.
Right, yeah. And I was doing let's call it a public discussion, or turned into something of a debate in India a few years ago. And when the person I had exchanged and so forth, and it was made open to questions from the audience, a young man stepped up to the mic and said, "How incredible the experience is when you finally realize that you, Atman, is Brahman." Tatvan Asi, does Christianity have anything like that? And of course I said, absolutely not. But also what I could have said is, and you cannot really believe it either. I mean, if we don't have concepts or terms, we can say that, maybe, tat, but anything else that you ascribe to it, you really can't think, and maybe you can have an enlightenment experience, changes your life, makes you look differently at the world around you and at other people. But the impersonal may be there as far as they're concerned, but you can't get away from the personal when it comes to your daily life.
Yeah. So when it's interesting because they do talk about the impersonal being transcendent beyond words, beyond what we can understand, and that we are trying to understand, say, Brahma or Vishnu through what is personal, obviously, because we are anthropomorphic, we are human, we are, this is how we know things. What is the difference? And I think this is crucial for a lot of us. For myself, it was very helpful to read what you had to say about this. What is the difference between Yahweh being beyond our understanding and somebody something like a Brahma being beyond our understanding? What is the fundamental difference between, or some differences, between Yahweh being beyond what we can comprehend and the Brahman or the Atman being beyond what we can comprehend?
Okay, good question. The answer is, the difference is in revelation. Okay, we believe in a God who is transcendent and who has the attributes that we associate with a God. He is good and not evil. He has knowledge. He is not ignorant, and so forth. Now, we add that he does not just have knowledge, but he's omniscient. He knows all there is. He's not good, but he is goodness, if you want to put it that way. He is love.
Yeah.
So we know that God is those things by way of analogy. Now, philosophers of religion often have a lot of, you know, we have a lot of debate on that. You know, what does analogy mean? It means that you take the concept that we humans have and apply it to God without the limitations. But it is positive knowledge. It's not just an equivocation, which would mean that we really can't know anything about God unless he has communicated it to us, nor is it univocal. God is not finite the way that we are, but there is an analogy between our understanding of God and the world and what he really knows. There is a common element, and there is that distinction that makes him different. And we have that with Yahweh. I think we can apply the same thing to Krishna. And so we would have to decide on the basis of the scriptures and the supposed revelation which one is right. But when you come to the question of what is pantheism or monism and what is theism, I think the key is self-disclosure.
Okay. And it seems that the difference I've noticed with Christianity and these other religions in terms of the kind of revelatory disclosure that God gives us or that a Krishna gives us, the difference in Christianity is it seems to be fully committed to this God revealing himself to us in a particular place, in a particular time, very historical. The Christian faith is largely predicated upon God acting in history at a specific time and place to a specific people. When I read of the accounts of the Gita or of Krishna or of any of these other origin stories that are in the holy scriptures of these other traditions, it seems when that there is, I have lack of a better word, a de-emphasis that history, when and where, is not as important to these other faith traditions as it is to Christianity. Is that true?
That is very definitely true. Take Buddhism. Buddhism was founded by Siddhartha Gautama. At least that's the first thing that you learn about it. But then if you go into more depth, you realize that, say, Theravada Buddhism says there were 20-some previous Buddhas who taught the identical message, and there will be for the most conservative, at least one more Buddha. In the larger Mahayana schools, there will be millions of more Buddhas. And so the historical person is important because he brought the message supposedly to this age, but that's really what all he did. I mean, you know, even if you buy into the entire story, he was obviously a successful teacher and he felt compassion for people and so forth. But the one thing he didn't do is atone for our sins.
Yeah.
No, that sounds pretty flippant almost. But I heard somebody, well, in a discussion, one of my former colleagues said, you know, if it were decisively proven that Jesus did not die on the cross, then I would not give up being a Christian. I would be a very confused Christian, but I would not stop being a Christian. And you know, what I did not say, once again, was you are already confused. You just, I mean, the whole point of Christianity is that at a certain place and time, God incarnate atoned for our sins on the cross. And, you know, without that.
Paul says we are miserable. We are still in our sins.
Yeah.
In 1 Corinthians 15 there. So that brings me to my next question, Wynn. Several of these religions that you talk about in your third edition have something to say about Jesus, and some of them are even quite friendly to the idea of incorporating Jesus as a manifestation, as an avatar of some kind. Where does Jesus figure into these bigger faith traditions, and how have you seen in your travels and experience throughout the world and talking to people of different traditions, how do you see Jesus in the midst of the world religions today? Where is he? How is he? I mean, I know he's mentioned in the Quran, and he's considered an avatar in the Baha'i faith, I believe. What's the overall perspective that Jesus fits into in some of these traditions?
Yeah, fits into is the correct expression because it is a matter of fitting him
right
into the particular religions. Now, Muslims tell me we really have more in common than you think because we honor Jesus. He was the second greatest prophet. Venerate him. We acknowledge him as a prophet.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, he wasn't God because only Allah is God and no human being can be God.
Right.
As a matter of fact, you know, it takes a little bit of theological sophistication to make that distinction clear to some Christians.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, God incarnate is one person in with two natures. But so it depends on which particular branch of Islam you talk about. According to one Sunni tradition, they expect the Mahdi to come. Now, some say Jesus was the Mahdi, will mm-hmm. be the Mahdi mm-hmm. when he returns. Others say after he has come, Jesus will return and in a way preside over the last judgment. He will descend on the mosque in Damascus, and from there the last judgment will take place. Others say that, well, he was a great prophet, but his teaching has been distorted by the Jews, the Christians, and so forth, and we have it in pure form. And then they deny the central aspects of God. that we as Christians recognize in Allah's own words, there is no Trinity. Jesus is not God in the Quran. So there's quite a gap there.
Yes, yes. How does he fit into the more Indo-European and Eastern religion traditions with Jesus?
There are a number of people who incorporate Jesus as an avatar. You have the Ramakrishna Society, and if you go to one of their temples, you're going to look at a row of statues that include Ramakrishna, his wife, the Buddha, some other Hindu deity, and Jesus. And so he is considered one of the manifestations of God. But again, the biblical picture of God is lost in the process because he is accommodated to Ramakrishna's monism.
Yeah, yeah.
You mentioned Baha'i earlier. Baha'i has 9 great manifestations of God, and you go down the list, and you come to Jesus, and again, Jesus is one of Baha'u'llah's ideas of a manifestation of God. Now, the silly Christians took the idea of Jesus' return literally. Jesus gave them certain signs that to look for that he would return, and the Christians didn't realize that those were spiritual signs. And so they've looked at world events and so forth and said, well, looking at what he said, he hasn't come back yet. And so that silly, literalistic understanding of Jesus' teaching has made them miss the fact that Muhammad was actually the second coming of Christ. That's the Baha'i faith.
Helping you to give a defense of Christ to your non-Christian neighbor. This is Apologetics Profile. You can help support Apologetics Profile by becoming a patron of the podcast at patreon.com/watchmanfellowship. That's patreon.com/watchmanfellowship.